Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. Glad to be back with you. I've got to remember to get in touch with PRN and add my new book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, to the introduction. Been a little slow on doing that. I'm very busy, people, my friends out there, doing a lot of legal work. Got a request from a psychology journal to do an overview of my views on pharmacology, psychopharmacology, and that's been accepted, and got to finish that up in response to a few questions. Just really, really busy doing good things. And, of course, my practice. So I just thought I'd let you all know that I'm here perking away at all the things I've just done for a long, long time in different proportions. More legal work now than ever. And I'm keeping my practice a little smaller and keeping it local. I'm really delighted to continue to have this opportunity to be on PRN. It's just a wonderful thing that Gary Null has set up and is continuing to support. And I think that's all I'll say, because I have a wild man for a guest. He's unpredictable. He's funny. He's very insightful. He has a mission, much as I have a mission. He was outstanding at our conference. Maybe I'll ask him about that. His name is Michael W. Corrigan. He's an EDD. He's a tenured professor at Marshall. He has a lot of focus on educational psychology, human development, and also research methods. I'm trying to figure out an article that I could invite him into to do some research methods stuff. He's got large-scale projects going at 5 U.S. Department of Education fund studies. He can tell us more about that. He's got National Science Foundation grants. I don't know how he manages to do that when he's being so critical of the psychiatric drugging of children, which is how I know him so well. He just presents in a sterling manner, especially standing up in front of folks and talking about these issues. And he also has a new book out. Michael, are you there?
I am. How are you?
I'm good. What's the name of your new book again?
Debunking ADHD, 10 Reasons to Stop Drugging Kids for Acting Like Kids.
Did it sell well? Did you have it at the conference? Did it sell well?
You sold every book I had at the conference.
Yeah. I think you did better than I did. It's a good book. You present wonderfully. And his website is really good, too. It's easy to find him, Michael W. Corrigan. He's got a great website on the drugging of children. It's just so great to have you doing that work.
Well,
what'd you think of the conference?
It was phenomenal. As a professor, I've had to go to numerous conferences every year for a decade more now. And I'll be honest, I normally present, and I might see one or two speakers, and then I kind of hide out at the hotel pool. But I honestly caught every single speaker you had at the conference except one. And I was just enthralled the whole time.
I learned a lot. Really a marvelous group of people, and the information about the conference I think is still up on our website. Not on Bregan.com anymore, but it's still up on empathictherapy.org if you just want to list some of the most interesting people in our field today. It was really, really good.
Yeah, I really liked them. I never met Dr. Karen before, and just hearing him speak and the research he's done on that Michigan study on schizophrenia was just really, really rewarding. And that whole, you know, I kind of went to, the, I mean, I knew what empathic therapy was, is the way you approached it, but I was just wondering how others might look at it. And to me, that's what really hit home was it's just such an honest, caring approach to psychiatry or clinical psychology, and that, you know, people really do have issues, and that's okay because we all run into it, but, you know, here's how we actually can get through them. And I was just pretty interesting to see how the different research presented, like the gentleman from Denmark.
Yes, Peter Gerche.
Yeah, he was presenting on that depression, and I'd never seen that research presented in that way, in that, you know, the one chart he put up, there was a chart he put up during one of his talks that he was showing how the treatment effects of medication versus the natural healing of depression with control groups and experimental groups, you know, with experimental groups getting the drugs and control groups just getting therapy, you know, he shows that, you know, over 4 months, everybody kind of heals, you know, whether you're on drugs or not. And the problem is when they stay on drugs, that's when the problems start getting different and worse. And I just thought that was, you know, an eye-opener to me as to, you know, there's a normal healing process that takes place. There's a, you know, from my perspective, there's a normal developmental process that takes place with kids for them to learn these behaviors so many want them to have immediately. But then, you know, these different research studies everybody was showing is, you know, schizophrenia was, you know, I hate to use the word cured, but treated effectively, you know, and depression's been treated effectively. And it's like that literature doesn't exist for most people to readily, you know, get a hold of and realize, you know, drugs aren't the answer.
It's really, really is true. And I was just really struck by how all of us were talking about caring relationships and how all of us were talking about trauma in childhood and stress in childhood and the inevitable problems of growing up, that how this was just a common human condition and some folks got more stressed and more traumatized. But it was all about that really normal process of meeting trauma, meeting stress, conflict, and growing through it and continuing to develop as a loving and self-determining human being, and that therapists and other people can help along the way if they start with a caring relationship. That just seemed to be part of everybody's theme, whether it was having people go into homes in the Swedish project and live on farms to recover from psychosis or from you know, other kinds of suffering, or whether it was the Finnish program of family interventions in Lapland, where a team goes in and relates to folks and helps them out and virtually eradicating so-called schizophrenia in Lapland. That it's always about relationship and often about family life and recovering from trauma.
Yeah, and
common.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, please.
I was going to say the other part of the conference, you had Tom Ryan, right?
Yes.
The pediatrician from Georgia. And then you had another pediatrician get up, and I didn't catch her name. She's from Iowa, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But that to me was just so wonderful to hear, because, you know, they say more than 60% of the kids being, you know, diagnosed these days with ADHD and depression are having that done at the pediatrician's office. And to hear two pediatricians, even, you know, beyond just the people providing therapy, all the different therapists,
yes,
that were there and the different speakers, but beyond that, you know, here were some pediatricians that said, it's time to sit down. Instead of me sitting down and diagnosing a child and writing a prescription, I'm going to use that time to sit down with this child and their parents and go through and give them a prescription on how we can help that child get better without me prescribing drugs.
Yeah. That was Sharon. The other pediatrician was Sharon Collins. I just didn't get to interject that.
Yeah, Sharon,
and
she was
she
great.
She just came to visit, and I thought, oh, have her come up and talk a little bit also with Tom Ryan about being a pediatrician who doesn't diagnose and drug kids psychiatrically.
Yeah, she did a really good job for not having to prepare, knowing she had to prepare for the conference.
I think it was her first conference ever, actually. I think it may be the first time she's talked about that on a stage.
Yeah.
Well,
I thought the attendees were, you never know when you go to speak at conferences who's going to be there, and you always, with my talk anyways, I always try to gauge who my audience is. But it was such a diverse group of attendees too. You had practitioners, you had scientists, you had academic people, you had, clinicians, you had church groups, and you had, patients that were, just trying to recover. You had tons of parents there that had gone through some really unfortunate nightmares, with their children related to mental health and pharmaceuticals. So I never, being at the conference for the 3 days, like every corner I turned, someone wanted to talk to me, or, I'd get on the elevator, someone was there. But they all had a story, and they wanted to be a part of the conference. I think that's what's great about your conference is people are coming because they want to be a part of it. They're not just necessarily coming to learn. They want to, figure out what they can do to help others avoid some of the pitfalls they've encountered personally, or figure out a better way to help others, in their profession.
Yes, very dedicated people. And folks really enjoyed your presentation. You do such a great job at breaking down the basics and the most important elements of what's the matter with drugging kids and diagnosing kids. Why don't you take a few minutes and just talk about your views on ADHD and drugging?
Sure. I think it, when I really first started researching it, if people wanted to learn more about my viewpoints, they can. I don't have a website per se, but I do have a channel on YouTube called Debunking ADHD. So if they just go to YouTube and type in Debunking ADHD, they'll see a channel there. And a few of the videos tell my story, and there's another video there on the 10-minute diagnosis for ADHD. It's a fun but informative video. But I try to make everything fun because it's just such a personal.
Let me interrupt a minute, because I got to a website that had your blogs on it, and they were there in a very orderly way when I put your name in. So people could read about, it started out with a blog about infants and children. And then
I have a Facebook page as well. Unless someone started a website, I'll have to Google it when we get off. I don't have a website, but I'm on Mad in America as a blogger.
You know what? Maybe it's Mad in America
And I'm on Psychology Today as well, too.
Yeah. That's great that you're on Psychology Today, too.
Yeah, it's a really large audience.
I think it was your Mad in America, maybe. They've got all your blogs up along with your bio, and it's a real introduction to your work.
Yeah. So there's a few ways to come into it, but, I stumbled into this arena on my research. As you were saying, I've had a number of grants with the U.S. Department of Ed, National Science Foundation, and worked through Department of Justice. So I've done a lot of work in schools, and I've studied a lot of kids. And I teach child development and research methods. So I was in a school, and I just, ran, and I've told you the story before, but it was finally the day where the clicking point for me was, I just watched a third of the kids I was in line with going to lunch get drugged, and I just went home that day. And that was the day I started researching, because I walked in, my wife's a clinical psychologist, a marriage family therapist, and when I walked in, the first question I asked was, where's your DSM? You know, where's your Diagnostic Statistical Manual? She's like, what? And I looked in it, and I looked at the ADHD diagnosis, and I read through the whole criteria they had through there and the little bit of research they cited and their wording as to how to, you know, but they're covering their butt constantly throughout the whole wording. So I just said, oh my God, I just got to start looking into this. So I kept reading it more. I actually went back to my office the next day, and I had a number of research assistants at that time, and I put two of them on finding me every meta-analysis on ADHD there was. So I just kept researching and researching. Then I started discovering that everybody on these meta-analysis, for the most part, and all these, you know, thousands of publications on ADHD, if you read close enough and look at the whole document, you're going to find out that they're being paid by the pharmaceutical companies for talks and promotional talks and different things. So I was like, it just seemed really, really cloudy to me. And when I first started speaking about it, it was at a school system that I was speaking on education and character development. And actually someone from the crowd asked me, you know, what they could do with these ADHD kids' character. And she was not a really nice lady who stood up and asked the question, and she kind of made them sound like lesser beings. And I, you know, I explained to her as politely as I could that day that, you know, if I was a kid today, I would probably be that child you're talking about, because I'm all over the place. I lose my phone at least 7 times a week. You know, I constantly are thinking and daydreaming about different things. I hit probably 17 of the 18 symptoms. And so when I first started writing about it, after that one, it was just kind of a confrontational thing, and I got an applause, and she sat down and looked even madder after it. But I realized I wanted to make this a lighthearted approach. I wanted to make it a honest but caring, but, you know, when I speak about it, I just want to try to make it fun because, you know, if we don't laugh as parents, and we have two kids that are great and challenges at the same time, but if we don't laugh as parents, we're the ones who are going to go insane, you know. So to me, it's, you know, we have to take a moment back and laugh. And what I try to do in my presentation is just show them that, you know, what they're telling you is a brain disease, and these symptoms that they're telling you are evidence of this are also the same symptoms we use to diagnose gifted children. They're also the same symptoms we use to diagnose developmental delays, which are temporary in nature. They're also the same, you know, symptoms that describe about, you know, 98% of the kids in the world. So I go through in my book, and I go through in the research, the research that they're trying to claim as evidence of this is just so flawed, and you've done it wonderfully in a number of your books. It's just the brain scans aren't there, environmental influences such as pesticides and stuff, those are just humorous studies to read to someone who knows methodology. I mean, they're having a telemarketing company call up parents who took part in a pesticide study where their child provided a urine sample, and their a telemarketer is using an abbreviated version of the diagnosis to diagnose the child ADHD on the phone, not even talking to the child, just talking to the parent, and then trying to show that these children had higher levels of pesticide. So, you know, will pesticides actually cause children to, you know, if they have a high level of pesticide, will that cause them to behave more erratically, more differently, not focus as much? I would think so, you know, but is that ADHD? So it's just, when you go through all that research and my God, when you read the disclaimers of all these drugs, and some, they want to say these on rare occasions. If they're rare occasions, then I must be hanging out in some very rare places, because everywhere I go to talk, you know, people I meet that know me or that have friends, everywhere I go, these parents have ran into these rare occasions, and their children are having tics, and their children are having, you know, depression now, and their children are doing this, this, and that. And it's like, they want you to believe the disclaimers aren't going to happen, but those are real. That's why your legal practice is growing. So I try to just show them, here's the facts, here's what they're trying to tell you, But here's what we know about kids, and that's where in the second part of my book I focus on child development, and these are just things we're going to run into. And, you know, school, we're going to run into issues with even the smartest children in school, you know, no matter what's going on, because, you know, school's hard and childhood's hard. So, me, I love speaking in front of people. I love sharing the story. The reason, you know, when you sit down and write a book like that, it's like, do I really want to jump into this, you know, ocean? Because it's not a small pond you're jumping into when you attack the DSM or pharmaceutical companies. But it's been interesting. And I you know, the book sold all right. I wish it, I'm not retiring in the Virgin Islands like I would like to someday, but it's sold fairly decent here. It's sold pretty good overseas as well, from what I've been told. But I think people are still just a little afraid to talk about this. It's still just such a taboo subject to so many individuals. You know, they're kind of afraid to endorse you, but they agree with you. So I've run into a lot of people that I know or that know me, and they say, you know, I really want to like your page. I read it all the time, you know, on Facebook, but I'm afraid to like it because I'm a superintendent or I'm a principal, and I'm afraid, you know, if parents found out I like that page, you know, I'd get in trouble.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's still kind of a tiptoe thing.
Principals and teachers are afraid.
Yeah,
I'd not heard about that before, but I can imagine.
Yeah, I had a board member, head of a school board, talk to me the other week. She's like, "Oh, I've read your book," you know. But you know, people don't, and she liked it, you know, and she read it for personal reasons. But you know, a lot of people don't want to come out and say this is where we're at, because that's the hardest thing. That's why I try to make it lighthearted in my talks. Is, you know, a lot of folks when they've been told they're ADHD, or when they've been told their child is ADHD, that's part of the nice part about the DSM. It gives us a term, a label, an identity, you know, as to, well, this is what's been my issue. You know, I'm this. So many have been told that their children are this, and when you tell them that they're not this, you know, it's kind of like debating, you know, whose God is the right God or the only God. You know, it's stepping across that line as to, you know, but I wrote a blog one time, but you don't know my Billy. You know, I have people come up to me all the time that say, you know, well, I really liked your talk and I can see where you're coming from, but you don't know my, you know, my son, you know. And I'm like, well, I'd be glad to drop my son off for 8 hours on any Saturday you want to, and then we can talk afterward. Because, you know, I love my children. I taught in a juvenile detention center for a number of years. You know, I have had thousands of students at the college level. I've met plenty of students that fit the description of ADHD. And to me, those are some of the most interesting, most creative, most intelligent kids there are. So what's the last thing we want to do for the youth that are going to be our future? And to me, that's drugging them and taking away that spirit they have, that creativity, that energy, you know. So I just try to play semantics and you know, switch it around on them. They say they're highly hyperactive. I call them highly energetic. You know, they say they talk too much. I say you don't listen well. You know, it's just a game being played to me with kids, and that's where I just draw the line. I really, you know, some adults want to, you know, accept the diagnosis and take the drugs, then you know more power to them. But for us to force this on kids, for schools to be encouraging, and I'll use quote marks with that, parents to have their child diagnosed, it just crosses the barrier. Because you know as well as I do, if they go to a certain clinic in any certain city, you know, there are very few children that walk out of that clinic that don't get diagnosed ADHD or depressed or whatever. So it just keeps getting worse and worse.
It's a quite bizarre situation. I'm familiar with a psychiatrist who has 4,000 patients at least until he gave up his license. He had 4,000 patients, 85% diagnosed ADHD. So this is such a large-scale business for some people. It's not a professional activity anymore. It's a big business. Psychiatrists, pediatricians, you know, we're the salespersons for the drug industry. You know that as well as anyone on earth. Something that I've been noticing is I've been going occasionally invited to teach at colleges and universities. The colleges seem to be more and more, by very large ratios, mainly women. And you and I haven't talked about this. Maybe we could start and talk about it in the second part of the hour. But is this drugging of our boys a part of a general emasculation so that our boys are not even making it in college anymore, so that you have ratios at some colleges that I've been to of 4 and 5 women to 1 guy?
That sounds like a great college to me. That's why I went to Bowling Green State for undergrad.
Yes.
There was 5 women to every guy. No, I'm just
kidding. That's because you're ADHD and you had a lot of energy.
Yeah.
I think you'll
find different colleges like that. You know, I've taught at several state universities now and a private school. I haven't really seen that be the case, you know, with more women. I think more women are going to college, and I think that's great. But I really haven't noticed the downfall of men. Now, in the College of Education, where I teach my undergrad courses at Marshall, it's nearly all women, because that's just education in general. We have too few males going in to become teachers, you know, which is a bad thing, which I think could really help. You know, I think, what do you call it, your acronym for ADHD, the father?
The DADD, Dad Attention Deficit Disorder.
Yeah, I mean, imagine, you know, how many male boys could benefit from having more male teachers, you know, in the schools helping them. And it's not there. So I think it just depends on, a lot of times I'm not sure which department you're speaking to. So it really depends on what major or which college.
No, I was looking around universities. Kearney, Nebraska, there were 5 or 6 to 1 girls over the boys in the cafeteria, and I was talking to a professor friend of mine there, and she said that this is becoming a national pattern, and that she was concerned that the drugs had something to do with it, but it also was a general, what she felt was emasculating of men that was going on.
That's interesting.
Fewer and fewer men were making something out of themselves and striving to do so. Maybe I can, you know, do a little noodling around researching and see if anybody is noticing this phenomena.
Well, they're not going into the military. I heard a really interesting talk on NPR a few months back, and they had one of the big generals who are part of the recruiting, and he was explaining they were talking about why so many aren't allowed into the military now. And I don't remember the exact, but I think he said that in order for someone to be accepted into the military, if they were diagnosed with ADHD and have been on those drugs or depression drugs, they will have had to been off of them for 2 years before they can join the military. So there's
a large percentage of them
being let in. I think he said close to 30, it was either 15 or 30% of the people they deny are due to the medications they're on.
Well, that's something else I want to look into, because I didn't know that was still in force. I knew that was in force a decade ago, but I thought now that they were drugging so many people in the military, I thought that had been dropped. So that's another thing to look into.
Well, obesity was on the major list of the reasons they were not taking people in, too.
And some of that's drug-induced, probably.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Well, we're going to go to break. When we come back, I'd love you to dive into, just really communicate with people about the ADHD research and the drug research and maybe I can add something to it. And let's do some, have a cutting edge conversation about all that stuff.
Okay. I'll take some Adderall and I'll be right back.
All right.
I'm just kidding.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. You might hear that I'm a little hoarse. I think I'm a little slower than usual today. So I've decided I have to rev myself up. And I have no better person in the whole world for revving up than Michael W. Corrigan, educator, and a man who, thank God, is on a mission, joins my mission, I hope. He's actually doing it quite independent of me. Totally independently of me, just broadcasting the news about ADHD and in general what we're doing to our kids. So give you back the mic, sir.
Well, I appreciate it. Yeah, I one thing I wrote about recently, it was on Psychology Today. I'm not sure if it was, every now and then I'm putting them both on at the same time on Mad America and Psychology Today, but I wrote a piece called Mind-Bottling Malarkey, Medicine or Malpractice. And what prompted me to write that was I came across some statistics from IMS Health, and it had a breakdown of the 8,389,000 kids from 0 to 17 years of age on psychiatric drugs. And, you know, I normally write about ADHD. I write about child development. I write about education. But this one just, I couldn't believe it, what I read, because I remembered a headline. I think Alan Schwartz might have wrote about it in New York Times, but it was like 10,000 infants are on ADHD drugs. And that made massive news, right? Everybody was sharing that. Well, it turns out that 1.1 million infants and toddlers and preschoolers and kindergartners are on these drugs. And actually, more than 300,000 are 1 year old or less. 370,000 are 2 or 3 years old. So this study, and CritNet broke it down a little more clearly, what blew me away was when I discovered that there are 500,000 kids, 3 or younger, being drugged for anxiety disorder. And once again, I pulled out the DSM we have here and started looking at it. And they, you know, they're diagnosing these kids with all kinds of different anxiety. But I mean, separation anxiety, that's part of Jean Piaget's, you know, developmental stages. You know, that's a common thing that every child goes through in that, you know, those first, second stages. It just takes a while to get through it. So they're now using anxiety, separation anxiety, to, you know, put kids on anxiety drugs. And I was just horrified when I read that it was 1.1 million. Now, 4.5 million of that 8-plus million are actually on ADHD drugs. So, you know, the ADHD drug companies are winning the business race there. But it's just gotten to the point where, I mean, how many more? I did a chart in one of my videos, if they watch that on Debunking ADHD or go to my Facebook page, that there's a chart there that if you project these numbers out, the way they've been growing over the past 2 decades and move forward, in 30 years we'll be drugging 54% of our kids in schools. And that just sounds like a science fiction book I read back in the 80s, you know, where we're actually going to drug that many kids because they're having a hard time sitting. I recently spoke at my high school. I was surprisingly made part of their Alumni Hall of Fame. And one of my teachers had, and coach, he was also my coach, had nominated me. And it was fun to be there because I saw some people I hadn't seen in a long time. And what they would have clarified was I was the guy that needed to stand in the back of the room and walk around because I couldn't sit there for an hour listening to stuff that I thought should have taken 5 minutes. I'm still that way at conferences. So we're drugging these kids for having to sit through school. And to me, I try to ask adults, you know, when was the last time you sat for 7 hours of direct instruction? You know, could you do it, Peter?
I was exhausted after emceeing 2.5 days, and often I would take breaks, but not this year because everybody was so good. But no, I mean, I don't. You'd have to pay. Even if you paid me $1 million a year, I wouldn't go back and live through fourth grade sitting in class.
I'd do it for $1 million, but
I wouldn't. Oh my God!
But yeah,
one thing, I'd end up in detention.
Yeah, it's really tough, and I mean I admire educators too. You know, I try to explain to teachers when they're, or to parents when they're complaining about the teachers, I'm like, so do your children have the ability to drive you a little bonkers on a day you have them all day long? You know, and if you've got one or two or three kids, and most of them will say yes, you know, that's the problem, right? And then I said, well, imagine having 25 of them, or in some of these larger urban districts, they have over 40 kids in a classroom. Imagine being a teacher somehow trying to entertain and educate and manage that many different children with those that many different behaviors. So to some degree, you know, the model of education has always been a challenge to children because they're the ones having to sit there and take it. And we need education. I mean, it's the most important thing to me we have in our society right now, is if we could direct a lot more money towards education and cut the 60 or 70% of those dollars that we're spending on testing and focus on promoting, you know, evading children to, you know, become amazing people, you know, instead of just trying to get them to academic proficiency, I think we'd be making strides, you know, in our society. Beyond that, we wouldn't be having these issues. But to some degree, I think education's leading to this. I think to some degree, the medical practice, this whole, you know, brain disease model, they're trying to sell folks like they have research to back this up. The research isn't there. And, you know, my wife and I were driving home, and she's like, I just wonder, she asked me the question, I just wonder how many clinical therapists have read the research that shows that this stuff doesn't exist. You know, that it shows that these few little studies are what they are using to justify this diagnosis. Robert Foltz, another gentleman you had speak, he had a slide up that showed that of the three or four studies that they're using to justify bipolar as a disorder in the DSM, do you remember what the total number of participants were for those three or four studies he showed?
It was bizarre. There was like 12 and one or something.
Yeah, it was a total of 73 people or 74 people that they've studied to justify putting bipolar, you know, on, you know, all these different, you know, millions of people, right? And it's like there's little research behind it. But if you go to a doctor who believes in that model, they're going to tell you this is real, blah, blah, blah. Well, if I don't know if they've read the research, and that's what's irritating to me.
Well,
we know
they haven't.
Yes.
In fact, I was the first doctor in history to begin reading that research.
Well, shame on you for reading.
I don't even think the guys who wrote a lot of it read it because they didn't really write it. Drug company people were writing it for them. I think for a lot of that research, I was the first doctor to actually read it all.
Well, someone read it when they put it all together, here's the sad part. If they had so much research on bipolar to justify throwing this into the DSM, why did they only end up with those few studies as what they were citing? You know, if that goes to show you how weak the research is behind that, you know, there's the problem. When you look at what they barely, you know, what they cite and then back away from in ADHD, it's even worse. And it's genius at the bottom level. I mean, when you look at what these companies, what these individuals have accomplished, it's genius from a business perspective. It's the most unethical thing from a human perspective, though, that we could, you know, even imagine ever happening. But they just seem to they are just unbelievably great at bearing the truth and, you know, shaking the keys and distracting people from asking the right questions. And, you know, that honestly, I mean, I wrote a long, it's not a long book, it's a couple hundred pages, but it took me a good year to research and write. And I honestly think more people watch my videos than read my book. I think most people have short attention spans. We want the news. We want the information. We want it now. You know, they tell you to make videos, you know, 30 seconds or less than 3 minutes if you're going to get these folks. And, you know, so that's where I've really started leaning towards making videos to try to educate people or provide, you know, or just entice them to look at, you know, more information. But I don't think the media's coverage is there. And I recently, a supporter of mine sent me a care package, and in that were a collection of DVDs. And on one of those DVDs was an assortment of news coverage on ADHD, on the drugging of kids, on depression drugs, so on and so on, spanning from like the early 90s to, you know, like 2010, right? And I think you were on probably three of the different news channels and coverage. Like you were on a Hannity and Combs thing with Fox News. You were on an old show on CNN called Talk Back Live. I don't know if you remember that. But there were, you know, all these different pieces. And so I started watching like the first one from like 1993, 94. And I was like, oh, my God, they're having the same discussion we should be having today, right? And then I watched another episode from like 1998. I think when you were on Hannity and Combs, Hillary Clinton had said something bad about drugging children or whatever, so they were initiating this effort to try to, you know, backstep and make good that we're not, you know, we're going to look into this drugging of kids. But you were on there and they were debating Hillary Clinton. But I was like, okay, it's politics, and it's still the same thing. And then, you know, 2008, there's another
actually,
episode.
Let me interrupt. I think that it's backward. Hillary Clinton sponsored the first White House conference on child psychiatry and had all the big druggers in. So it was Hillary never was critical of drugging children. She was a big part of the whole campaign to, you know, push biological psychiatry on kids.
Yeah, and the media brought it up like she was, you know, doing this or that. So what they did then to make up for that was they made that deal to the pharmaceutical companies that if you want a half year more on your patent, if you do clinical tests and show us the evidence, we'll give you a half year more on your patent. Well, that's millions, if not billions, of dollars to that industry. So they came back because they got, you're right, they got beat up by the pharmaceutical groups. Well, when that research came back, there was a piece that was seen on, I think it was Frontline, an old show, old episode. Well, they started looking at all the results. They were with the FDA and looking at the results of those clinical trials on the depression meds, right? And guess what they found? Nothing worked. Nothing worked as good as the therapy. Nothing worked as good as the placebo. You know, they found nothing on these drugs. And to me, and the FDA guy that was interviewed on the one show was watching, the reporter asked them, why are you still allowing these to be sold? And they're like, because we can't show that they're doing harm, you know. And then she pointed out all this stuff. So it's just, what's frustrating to me is there's just been the same sporadic media coverage for decades now on this issue, right? And now we can't even get, you know, those of us who are, you know, on this side of the battlefield on this, we can't even get media coverage. We can't even get, you know, individuals to get us on TV to discuss this. And some folks want to, you know, that reply to my blog, say it's a deal where it's basically the news stations are afraid of losing advertising dollars from the pharmaceutical companies. At times, I wonder if the newscasters are on some of these drugs and don't want to step into debating it as well. I just can't figure out why we can't have an honest discussion, because we're at 8 million, more than 8 million kids are being drugged for this. And if adults want to do whatever, like I said, that's their life, right? But these are kids, and we got plenty of studies. Your books outline plenty of examples. You know, therapists have plenty of clients that are just having a horrible life and trying to get through just the damage that's been done from the drugs they were prescribed earlier for issues that they thought they had. And, like, no one really in the major media, not, you know, they don't want to bring it up. So it's kind of aggravating, and it's and that's why we've started we've got, you know, hopefully you'll join us at some point, but we've got another, it's on Facebook, it's called Project for the Kids. But Robert Whitaker, myself, Dr. Marilyn Wedge, who's a psychiatrist and blogger on Psychology Today and author, we've got Gretchen Lefevre Watson, a bunch of different people. We have parents that have lost children to these drugs. We've got like a full day of education, and like my friends Jim and Charles Fay with Love and Logic will be there on some occasions to provide like parenting advice and tips. So we're going from major metropolitan area to major metropolitan area over the next year to really start sharing this with folks, you know, and we're going to be on some major university campuses and large auditoriums speaking to 500, 1,000, a couple thousand people. So we're in the midst of booking all those because we can't figure out another way to really get this message out there so that people have the evidence they need.
That's amazing, Michael. We're talking with Michael Corrigan, educator, concerned citizen, advocate on behalf of children. I'm amazed you're getting those kind of bookings.
Well, I think a lot of them are coming through academics and also clinicians that just feel the same way, that either teach in universities or other places. So
that's a huge sign that environment is changing.
Yeah,
that's
At some point a lot of people are trying to separate themselves from what's going on. You know, but
and
I think Bert Caren pointed out that there was some sort of publication that came out back in the day that showed that if you start medicating your clients, you'll make three times more money. So it's going to be hard to fight the machine. I don't think we're going to get that many clinicians to change their practices. I don't think we're going to get that many pediatricians to change their practices. We'll get a bunch of them when they start realizing how false the evidence they've been told is. Because, you know, most of these universities are teaching them this brain disease model because those universities are taking money from these, you know, pharmaceutical entities. But I think what we need to change is the education field so that they know what this is doing, because I'm telling you, educators and schools care about kids, you know, and what we need to do is change the knowledge base that parents have when it comes to this, because I've met hundreds, if not thousands, of parents that have told me, you know, my doctor told us that our kid was ADHD and he should be on drugs, and we told him no way in hell. We need more parents feeling that way, but also knowing that it's okay to feel that way, because, you know, if you look at the 2009, you know, multimodal study, the MTA study on ADHD, you're going to see that those drugs are worthless, completely worthless after 3 years. They do nothing. You know, they start losing their effect even after 14 months. So why, if you wanted to practice with this to get your child through a rough time, okay, we've passed that point. Now get them off that drugs, because the only thing that's going to come from being on those drugs for any longer are all these side effects that are going to lead to a depression diagnosis, and then more medications, and then all the side effects that are going to lead to them being on bipolar, and then leading to lithium, and then never moving out of your basement.
I want to interject that idea that they even worked for the 14 months is false. You start evaluating the processes they used
right. To
analyze, and they had hardly anything that could be called a controlled clinical trial. It was all fudged.
And that's the best they have, too. I have to give them credit. That was the most methodologically, technically, it was the best study that I've read. But their outcomes were not what they expected, and it's ridiculous that, you know, these kids that weren't on anything or didn't get anything weren't that worse off. You know, these kids that were not really getting the drugs, they were just as fine. The kids that had the worst behaviors at the end were what? They were on the drugs.
And of course, they're getting a lot of diseases. The only negative factor they even measured was heightened weight, And they proved once again that these are stunting drugs. They didn't even examine blood pressure or cardiac or neurological tics or OCD. I mean, they really were trying to come out really, really good.
Well, and I know we're going to run out of time, but the major thing that I try to share with people in my talks and in the book is that, you know, so I do research and evaluation for a living, basically, beyond my professor's job, and I teach it for my professor's job. And the main thing we need when we do a scientific study, especially if we're looking at, you know, psychological constructs, these things we can't see or measure with the blood test or a genetic test or a brain scan, which we can't with hardly any of these, right? We need a valid assessment that can statistically show us if these people actually have what they say they have, right? And there is no valid assessment for ADHD that currently exists out there, because the 18 questions they have and the little test they've created off those 18 questions, they don't have what's discriminant validity. They'll show that kids have higher levels of these things, but what it doesn't show is that which kids are ADHD, because So, for instance, the ADHD 18 symptoms, if they go and look at those on any of my, you know, places that I'm on the Internet, what you'll find is that assesses every child that's out there. You know, so when every kid takes that and 99% pass that test as ADHD, how can you determine who has ADHD and who doesn't have ADHD? And also, how can you determine the severity of the ADHD or if that severity was reduced if you don't have a valid assessment to stick into your statistical analysis? So every study they've ever done on ADHD doesn't have a valid assessment of if these kids that they put in the experimental group had ADHD to begin with and if the kids that went in the control group had ADHD or didn't have. It's just, if you don't have valid assessments, I don't know how you're getting published.
Now, you'd agree with me that logically – there is no such thing as ADHD. I mean, I want to make clear my opinion on that, Michael.
I wouldn't call it ADHD. I'd call it childhood. I'd call it boys. I'd call it normal behavior. It exists. Those behaviors exist.
Well, and I think
it's not a disease or a mental disorder.
Yeah, and if you don't discipline children or you traumatize them or you bore them to death, they'll show more and more of those kind of responses.
Yeah. Or if you do everything perfect and they end up in a class and start imitating people they want to be like, they might still do that. So
yep.
There's no stopping kids from acting like kids. You know, we just have to walk beside them and be that guide on the side as they're learning, you know, how to survive and succeed in this world.
I'm very excited about this tour you're doing. I don't know a lot about it. When does it begin?
We've got events in September. We're going to be releasing the dates here soon, but we're going to be in the Baltimore, D.C. area. It looks like Saturday, September 19th. We're going to be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, December 5th. We've got a Tampa Bay event coming up. We probably are going to do Columbus, Ohio in August. We're working on New York City right now. We've
now,
got a Pittsburgh one coming up.
Yeah.
As well.
Sounds huge. Who's the basic organizer behind this?
Me and Dr. Michael Gilbert up there in Syracuse.
Oh, that's marvelous.
Yeah.
Well, Michael's an old friend.
He's a good
that's
guy.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, and you're getting support from MIA, from Madden America?
They're helping, We're getting support from a few groups. We hope to get more. But honestly, I think we can fill. There's enough people that want to sit in these seats that we don't need to be paying any favors to anybody. But what we're hoping is that the therapists out there that agree with us, you know, join the site and start helping us promote the events in their local areas and reaching out. Because what we want to do is get on the listservs of these associations of marriage and family therapists, of school psychologists, of school counselors, and have them let people know that this event is coming and there's, you know, CEUs attached
what's
to it
the,
and that every parent could come too.
What's the website for this?
We don't have a website yet. We're working on that, but we do have a Facebook page called, and it's Project For The Kids, F-O-R The Kids. so they can find that. And we also, there is a, if they go to Mad America, there's an initiatives icon tab towards the bottom of the page, and if you click that, we have a full press release on what we're doing, what's coming. So it's getting real big. I think we'll have about 12 events before February when all is said and done. So we're just in the process of flushing it all out. But it's going to be a whole day, and the beginning is you just learn the facts that even the, you know, with Robert Whitaker, I mean, you had him there, he's amazing, but he just paints perfect picture without even expressing opinion necessarily as a journalist, by just showing, you know, here's what the pharmaceuticals research says, you know, and that's all you needed to know. Why would you ever do a drug after reading what they admit in their own research?
We're coming to an end. I'm glad to be learning more about the project. Say goodbye, folks, to Michael W. Corrigan, EDD. You can easily find him on the website. Thanks for listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
Thank you, Peter.